wrote this mostly, a long time ago, while I was living in West Virginia and then in China. So about 4 years ago. And it's called The Forgotten Ambitions of Alfred J. Ketchup. Mr. Ketchup said, "Nobody will stop with perfect if there is something better than perfect. I consider those years the golden years of our company and of my career. Both of these are now declining. Even my strength to resist their decline is dribbling slowly away like a dollop of gourmet ketchup spilled from a hot dog, its fall momentarily arrested by a napkin before it slips down the greasy declivity. All that beauty has been forgotten." Mr. Ketchup said, "Do you doubt that Heinz, with all his resources, did not develop the perfect recipe for ketchup? Or, to revert a degree or two, do you doubt that God, with all his resources, did not develop the perfect tomato?" And I replied, "No, perfection is all around us. Look at the McDonald's hamburger when competently assembled. The 99-cent inflatable beach ball," I said. "Keds! Starbucks house blend. The market is flooded with perfection," he said. "The people tire of perfection," I said. "We will go beyond perfection," Mr. Ketchup said. Those were the days of ingenuity and ambition, of pluperfect sublime artifice. But since the death of Alfred J. Ketchup, our company's highly successful founder, ambition has been poo-pooed around here. Lately, my co-workers avoid each other's eyes as they shuffle from canteen to computer game. And I have taken to weeping at the most unexpected moments, at the most inane promptings of sentiment. Today, I have held out well through the morning's first meeting, and I expect that I will now be recovered from the tears and throaty voice. In the elevator, the Art Deco ashtrays present themselves to me in all their beauty. The ashtrays alone could not make me weep, but with nobody else in the elevator, enthralled as I am in its gold-leaf mosaic of ancient Egypt, my thoughts turn to my colleagues waiting for me in the boardroom. Normally, I have no particular affection for them. Judd Blow is my age, but only recently graduated from a college where most students take at least 6 years to graduate. He and his wife Jenny long to move back to that town which, for all I can tell, is just another post-industrial football-crazed Midwestern town. Stanley Harding insists that I call him Stan, but that would be a submission to his workplace chumminess. He might send you flatulent animations by email if you called him Stan. Next to Judd, Stanley is the worst dressed in his faded polo shirts, Dockers, and canvas belt. But Judd has an excuse, being from one of those places where all the men have goatees. Then Roger Weathering, my boss. He lets me do what I want, which is about the extent to which respect goes nowadays in the gourmet ketchup industry. But just present him with a new business venture to open a gourmet Taco Bell franchise, as I intend to do today, and he will almost certainly laugh and walk away. They are all terrified of my ambition, just as I am terrified of their beauty. Because there is something beautiful about these men, isn't there? I stop the elevator between floors, a practice not uncommon among the smokers Judd and Stanley, and prepare for the tears. I see them sitting in that preposterous conference room around the mahogany picnic table, completely oblivious, or so I imagine, to their peculiar situations in life. Stanley, now in his early 50s, hasn't given a thought to tomorrow since the day Mr. Ketchup hired him 15 years ago. He never tires of the sticky stuff in the mailbox prank, and although he has not yet summoned the courage to do it, he never lets a week pass without threatening to Xerox his anus. "Just spread 'em, man! Hey, just spread 'em on that Gryptian glass!" Yet when it comes to the ketchup bottle-shaped pen he ritualistically uses for the completely paper-based accounting, or the cartoonish lines of figures he presents in finance meetings, he gives the impression of high seriousness, speaking in elevated tones that imply not pompousness, but reverence for the numbers his job depends on. Is this not innocence? Despite the baseness of his joking, his complacent passion for the reams of the ledgers. Is Stanley not as earnest as a child at play? The elevators remains between floors, and now the tears are dripping down my face from my eyes that blink to follow the line of emotive reasoning I discovered over the weekend. I spent the weekend in my apartment, cleaning during the day and drinking in the evenings. Maybe I was drinking too much. Normally, how much I had drunk would have been too much. Normally, I would have been depressed the day after a 3-day bout. But who could call this depression? It went like this. If I am, then A, then B, then C, then D. A through D being religious memories from childhood or more recent surprising experiences of beauty. Then E. Insert formerly despised acquaintance slash co-worker slash NPR personality here. Or, syllogistically compressed, if I, then E, with some kind of obligation to beauty binding the two. If I, in my quietest moments, if I, sitting alone late in the night at my clean kitchen table with a 120-watt light bulb above me, if I, 8 drinks distant from the Taco Bell plan, then all these others, distant from their ambitions and mannerisms, underneath light bulbs that cast beauty upon them. Don't ask me to connect the dots now. I'm only copying from a dirty napkin. It all seems to make sense in the elevator, though. But even as I cry, I know that this is sentimentality. I know what beauty is. It is not my weakness late at night. It is not the weakness of others in the quietness of solitude, as if my solitude ennobled the solitary hearts of others. Mr. Keechup would not have approved of this silliness. He hired me for marketing, but also as an idea man like himself. And oh, what ideas we had. Gourmet ketchup is lumpy, yellowish. I have never heard of a kid liking it. There are ingredients in it that very few people would eat unprocessed, but when they see the words advertised on the label, they buy. Caviar membrane, guar gum, which many products include but make the mistake of not advertising. Mustard greens, baking soda, turmeric, quinine, cod liver oil, and spices. We do not name the spices, giving the impression that our special spice mixture is the secret. But even the gourmet consumer will only take exotic consumption so far, so we thought it best to remain silent on the spices. Still, even exotic ingredients don't sell without the right price, which Mr. Keechup discovered after failing to sell his first batch for $5 per 6-ounce bottle. After intensive research, I found the optimum selling price of $8.49 per bottle. We adjust each year for inflation, but the formula remains the same. The people want to pay as much as they can. 5 years ago, before Mr. Keechup's death, we recognized a niche and introduced gourmet ketchup, coloring slightly altered, for $10.49 per 6-ounce bottle. It remains one of our best sellers. Before Mr. Keechup's death, he and I had planned great things. Roger Weathering pretended to support our plans, but after the funeral, I saw that he had no ambition. I have lived with his complacency and struggled against it for 4 years. But I am frightened that I might be falling into the same trap of satisfaction. Or rather, as I stand in the elevator and the tears are still standing water, despite uncharitable thoughts about Roger Weathering, I am afraid that in all these tears I will begin to find these people's complacency beautiful. Judd Blow's ordering desire to live on the same street as all his cousins and thus vanquish all desire begins to seem beautiful. If I allow this line of thinking to continue, soon I will prefer the merely perfect, or even the less than perfect, to the more than perfect. This, I tell myself, is the trap of satisfaction. It is not laziness, which we always recognize as bad, but a perverted sense of the beautiful that seduces us into complacency. I could blame the barber for my difficulties. I let my hair grow for as long as was decent, but after 3 months I had to return last week to one of the barbers along my walk from work to home. My thoughts were elsewhere, and I ended up walking into the cheapest barber shop in 10 blocks. The shop was small, with a single old leather shaving chair. The odor of disinfectant and air freshener mingled with a stale haze of cigarette smoke. The barber was sleeping in a stiff-backed wooden chair, while an evangelist thundered from a television stacked high with gospel video cassettes. When the door closed behind me, a bell rang and woke the barber, who immediately announced that he was 80 years old. He sat me in his chair and turned on an ancient electric clipper. The preacher walked to a piano, began to sing. The barber hummed along over the drone of the clippers. I shouted that I had a cowlick, while he inclined his ear to me, and continued to shave off whisk-broom-sized clumps of hair. A gentleman's haircut, he nodded. Not too short on top, I warned. A fine gentleman, he said, and dove his clippers down for a low buzz across my part. Then he stopped and pointed to the television. What a voice this man has! He closed his eyes, swaying with the music, the clippers still buzzing in his raised hand and coming closer to my ear with each sway. He hummed along with the videotape. Like a lamb who stillness keeps, before the cross he does not bleat. He, a sheep led to the knife, stood silent as a sacrifice. Oh, who will shear the shepherd's sheep, their blessed heads frizured to keep? And who will shave the Lamb of God, or cotton swab his precious blood? He who shears the true flock's fleece, he will be God's very priest. Though I do not worthy appear, say the word and I shall be sheared. As he swayed, he stopped cutting, but at the end of the hymn he took three more tender chops at my scalp. He bent to my level, peering from behind my head into the mirror. Fine, fine, he murmured. Now a shave. He rubbed his hand over a machine against the mirror that purred out shaving cream. When he lathered it behind my ears, it was hot and stung into the empty roots of the hairs he had pulled out. Then he threw an invisible lever that with a jolt canted me into a reclining position. When the straight-edge razor appeared in the mirror, I was terrified. As he went to work on my throat, he sang menacingly, coughing, hawking, a ghostly tune. O Lamb of God, that shaveth away the sins of the world. And then, after some absent mumblings, the antiphon, Have mercy upon us. The scuff-scuff of the razor was right there beside my ear, and he stopped now and then with the blade edged against my ear to emphasize a phrase of his madly repeated song. I was sure I would die. Not that he would kill me, but that something metaphysical would slip, and with it the razor. I was sure that he, too, was terrified, so I joined his song, letting it grunt from my chest like he did. But then he was finished, and in the mirror I could see that I had been spared. He hadn't hit a vein. My sideburns and tapering stood out from the clean skin, quite dignified and even beautiful. That's when the tears came for the first time, perhaps because I was relieved, but also, I strangely felt, because I wanted to continue with the song that so tremblingly faced terror. But I soon forgot my sobs when he took up his shaving brush and whisked at my face. A real gentleman, he said, and the apron was off me. I was standing up, paying the $6, telling him to keep the change on the 10, and he was asleep in his chair again when I walked out the door. Now, I like this damned haircut. After a shower, shampoo, and conditioner, it makes me look damned handsome. But the haircut itself is terrible, I know. During my weekend of drinks, I spent much time staring in the mirror at it. The sideburns are uneven, my cowlick sticks up, and my ears stick out. I have read plenty men's health magazines to know that it is not a good haircut. And yet, it makes my face look good. Bring something out in it that was not there before. But this absurdity will pass, I tell myself, flipping the elevator switch and wiping my eyes. Tomorrow I'll use my credit card to get an expensive haircut, and I will remind my insipid colleagues just what splendor stands to be regained around here. Tomorrow, or maybe in 3 days' time, I will not love these people more than God loves them. And if they don't back my plan today, I will start looking for jobs elsewhere. Maybe out there somewhere is another Mr. Ketchup who will share the gourmet Taco Bell vision. I have only to think of the extra perfect, the super sublime, and all this will pass. In the lobby, the marble parquet floors, another invention of Mr. Ketchup's, comfort me. I have Ketchup's anti-friction felt on my soles, so I go swish, swish across the lobby into the canteen, where I order a gourmet Coke for the meeting. While the girl is muddling the ingredients in a mortar and pestle, I wash my face in the bathroom. I force myself to see through the tears and am assured to see the ugliness of the haircut. At 30, I have settled into my life's weight of 175, which gives me a small double chin and baggy eyes if not completely well rested. I squeeze a dollop of Preparation H from the dispenser above the gold-rimmed sink and massage it into the bags around my eyes. When I return to the counter, my Coke is waiting for me, and I am already 5 minutes late, so I can't delay any longer. The boardroom is halfway between the business offices and the factory, just off the lobby. It is, appropriately, a gourmet boardroom, with plush ceiling-to-floor curtains and an e-motor that spins wistful swirls of dust motes across the heavy bands of permanent afternoon sunshine that fall across the ebony moldings and tessellated mohair carpets. Last week, one of the junior advertising boys, Murka, tacked a gaudily colored sacred heart to the boardroom door, and I am surprised to find it still there. I quickly remove it and put it in my pocket before going in. And I should stop and say here that Murka is a character from another story by Heinrich Böll, who, anyways, just, so there's a whole other, like, story coming in here. And he tacks a sacred heart to someone's, he, like, quits his job and tacks a sacred heart to his boss's door or something. And he records silences. It's called Murka's Collective Silences by Hunter. It's a great story. And he's sort of, like, he's a sound editor. And he sort of, like, keeps all of the clippings, all of the silent clippings, and then splices them all together and just plays them when he goes home at night. So this is sort of that character entering the story now. They are all there. I come in silently so I can watch them a moment. Roger Weathering, at the head of the mahogany picnic table, is staring out the window, sucking on the ketchup bottle pen in his mouth. He might as well have a nipple attached to it. Stanley and Judd, sitting at the far end of the table, are bent over a car audio magazine. It will be easy not to cry. Despite Roger Weathering's bottle sucking, it's not as if their complacency is the manifestation of a pristine childlikeness. How could I have been moved by this? My pitch may go better than I had thought. Stanley looks up. Hey, cakewalk, no Cokes for the rest of us? Sorry, Stanley, I say. I had other things on my mind. Judd looks up surreptitiously. I know that he fears the other things I could have on my mind. He comes into every meeting hoping for the complacent affirmation of the status quo. I know he is balancing my tone against the game of spades he was playing online before he had to come down to the meeting. He is wondering how serious I am and how much work the seriousness will require him. Of him. He says, "Women trouble, Wally?" "Sure," I say, something like that. "Anytime you need to talk, Wally, you know." "Yeah, anytime, Wally," Stanley says, and they snicker together. I sit down between them and Roger Weathering, take a drink of my Coke, and try to hate them for their chumminess. But if I, then E, and it can't be avoided. If I did have women trouble, it is true that they would be sympathetic. Not much help, probably, but sympathetic. "Hey, Roger," Stanley says. "You got women trouble, too?" "Hmm?" Roger finally turns from the window, the bottle still in his mouth. He blinks, then lazily clunks a solid platinum gavel on the table to convene the meeting. "What have you got?" he asks. Judd and Stanley have buried their heads in the magazine again, so I assume the question is meant for me. "This morning we had a problem." I pause to enjoy the nervousness on Roger's face. "But I just finished a conference call with our lawyer and a National Geographic editor, of all people, and it looks like everything is ironed out." "Go on," Roger says tensely. "Our Myanmarian supplier of simian collagen has been taken over by Maoist guerrillas, who are demanding a 500% price hike. The guerrillas have access to all our account information and are using it as part of their propaganda campaign against foreign investors. That's not a big deal. I've already arranged for a shipment of gorilla collagen from Madagascar. Same price. Lipid structure's close enough. But a National Geographic reporter's been living with the gorillas for 6 months. The gorillas in Madagascar? No, the gorillas in Myanmar. Mm-hmm. This guy wants to write about us in his article as an example of foreign exploitation of resources. Roger flutters his hands helplessly by his sides. Exploit means to take advantage of, I explain. I know what exploit means, he snaps. This is absurd. What do we have to do? Well, at first they insisted on meeting with you personally in Washington. The Washington Post wants in on it, too. They also brought up the sustainable resource issue. What? Something Mr. Keechup was negotiating with some health officials on the Chinese side of the border. It doesn't really matter. If you still want to do the interview, I can tell you more. But I know how busy you are. Roger Weathering nods sagaciously. So, I mentioned our plans to sponsor the Society's Mekong expedition. From there, it was straight to the donor liaison, and he's arranging things with the editor. There's a swish of tinny sound effects from Stanley's direction. He and Judd are suppressing giggles as they pretend not to be playing with Stanley's Palm Pilot. Roger grimaces and crosses his legs. Of course, I offer. If you want to handle this thing directly... He pinches his lips between thumb and forefinger, in imitation of a platypus. I can see his mind sputter into thinking mode. He sees two options. Either I am offering to take on the project so that I have room to slack and other things, in which case he should take the offer, or I am preparing to use it as collateral against a new scheme that will ultimately require more work of all of us. Well, as long as production isn't interrupted, he begins, I'll take care of it, I say. Stanley senses that we have concluded something and begins to gather his ledgers. Judd stands up, stretches, says, Well, if that's all I can do for you today... My heart begins to pound in my head, because now is the time. I feel Mr. Keechup smiling down on me. Slowly, I tell myself, casually. Actually, I say, there is just one more thing I'd like to run past you. Judd sits down, terrified. Stanley intently wets his finger to rub at a stain on his shirt belly. Imagine, I begin. And Roger's eyes congeal. I'm sorry. Imagine Keechup getting into the fast food industry. Ludicrous, you say? That's what I said when I was talking to some Taco Bell execs last month. Where were you talking to Taco Bell people? Roger asks suspiciously. Old friend of mine, I lie. College days. Anyway... We were sitting around talking one day, and someone there sort of jokingly said he wished we made gourmet ketchup salsa. Then someone said, why not gourmet tortillas, or tomatoes, or refried beans? You get the picture. Well, naturally, I was skeptical, because who wants to start a huge venture like that, right, when we're already doing just fine as we are? Stanley clunks on the table. Here, here. You can never trust those fast food people, Roger growls. Exactly what I said. You'd be an idiot to let them handle the marketing and processing because they couldn't differentiate the product enough to make it successful, and it'd just be mixed in with all their other crap. And the shipping would be a nightmare, Judd chimes in. Absolutely, I say. There would have to be at least two middlemen. And they're actually interested in this, Stanley says, thinking the danger has passed. No, not really. I told them everything you just told me, and they just sort of laughed it off. I'm sure they've forgotten about it now. I can see that my colleagues are relaxed now. They could sit around chewing the fat like this for another half hour. The gourmet caffeine surges through my veins like gourmet blood. Which is exactly what I need, I continue, if we want to pull off our own Taco Bell gourmet franchises. Outrageous, you say? And I say, yes! But when has Keechup Co. ever been inrageous? See, we buy individual franchises, just a few local ones to start off. We pay the full price, but all we use is the name of the building. Everything else, from menu to kitchen equipment to food supplies, we handle. No middlemen, except for our mestizo cooks and the brisk, impeccable counter staff will lure away from the IRS. We're the suppliers and the owners, so it all runs smoothly and we get maximum profit. A second grader will be able to do the math in Stan's books, and we take care of the marketing angle. No big national ads. I'm thinking more along the lines of articles in national magazines. It'd be the easiest thing in the world to lure the reporters in on this one. Think about the headlines. Thousands pay $6 for Taco Bell burrito. Fast food goes gourmet. It'd be free publicity. And as for product development, Roger, don't worry your little head. I have already talked to Chuck about it, and he's gung-ho, you know him. Basically, Roger, where you come in is when you go down to your mailbox once a month to collect the check. I am panting. I find I am on my feet, but I don't remember having stood up. I hear the dark Basquiat creak on its wall hanger. Roger is doodling on his pad and will not look up. Judd and Stanley are fidgeting with their briefcase locks. My last words echo back to me, and they are fatally enthusiastic. Like a chess player who has simultaneously taken his finger off his queen and realized that his queen is now in jeopardy, I wait for Roger Weathering to make the decisive move. That sounds like it could be a good idea, he says. He looks at Judd and Stanley. What do you guys think? They nod in alternation. But it'll take a lot of research and preparation, Roger says. It could be the kind of thing that looks good on paper, but when you actually look into it, it won't work. He raises a deferential hand. I'm not saying it won't work, but I'd want to see some concrete proof that it would before we commit to anything. Well, of course, I say. I've already got a business plan. We can go over it together. How about this, Roger says. How about if you come up with a complete business plan? Let's say we give it a couple months, and then we'll talk about it again. He looks at Judd and Stanley, who are already sniggering about some animation that Stanley has on his Palm Pilot. Sound good? They nod, though it is clear that they have no idea what was just said. Roger turns to me, looking me in the eyes for the first time all day. Sound good, he insists. I can't bear to see the victory in his eyes. I have failed to sneak up on him, to give him something to lose if he doesn't cooperate, failed even to capitalize on his obligation to me. This gesture, this meeting, in a couple months, has dispatched his obligation. Sure, I say. Sounds good. As Roger gets up to leave, Stanley shoves his Palm Pilot between my eyes and the suddenly despondent table I am staring at. No women troubles there, huh, Wally? In the frame, a line drawing of a medium-breasted, thimble-waisted, smiling girl does a couple tap steps in a ragged frock that just covers her dainty butt. Then she vanishes in a cyclonic spin, at the end of which she poses naked, breasts and butt jutting out, frock dangling from her little finger. She winks, and the wink is a star, which expands to fill the frame, then the animation loops again. Judd is looking over my other shoulder now. Yeah, she's a cute one, huh? He stands to take the screen away, but I grab it from him. I could watch the girl 100 times, just to feel the shocking absence of desire. Objectively, I know she is sexy. Her body is just light enough to pick her up with one hand and set her in position. All the curves and forms of her slight weight center around her sex, so you can set her there and just give her an occasional shove to rock her back and forth, no vertical movement required. But I feel no desire, not even the natural, irrational desire of every healthy man to save a cute animation from her exploiters and then to carry her away and live with her in Toontown. Oh, oh, this beautiful, chivalrous ideal, to marry her, to live in chaste, connubial bliss with her, to help her, and save her, and hold her. But I do not feel any of that now. I simply love her. I know her every thought. And because I love her, she can remain a line drawing, because that is what she is. Stanley and Judd are staring at me. Hey, check it out, Stanley says. You really dig that chick, don't you, man? Hey, when was the last time you saw some titty? Somebody's due for a visit to Miss Kitty's, Judd says. But the tears are coming again, and with them, rising from my chest, instead of the lust I should feel, the inane ditty, Have mercy upon us. Judd and Stanley freeze, mouths open. I tremblingly give the Palm Pilot back to Stanley and hurry out of the room, leaving my briefcase on the table. I hear them laughing behind me. Look what you've done now. Back in the elevator, I begin to rise to my office. Judd is right. Maybe I do need some of Miss Kitty's shock therapy to get my blood moving again. And yet, I am dead to beauty. I am crazy. The razor slipped. That inane ditty keeps coming back. I need to get out of here. I get out of the elevator on the fourth floor and walk back down the stairs. Dead to beauty, I walk out the door. And it occurs to me that I could just never come back. Or I could blow the whistle on our Myanmarian exploits. Or both. But nobody hires whistleblowers, and I would have to get another job. It wearies me just to think of searching for another job. But what about the Taco Bell plan? Buck up. Keep your eye on the prize. Keep moving through the downtimes. When the going gets tough... Our building is one of many old stately office buildings on a broad boulevard that was designed 100 years ago to be a bustling business center. Now, though, most of the buildings are vacant. The street-level storefronts are dusty and mildewed. Running the length of the boulevard, a garden strip is kept clean from trash, but the grass is patched and the dead rose bushes look like weeds. Even the few shiny compact cars parked along the sides of the street are sad, because you know the planners had intended these broad, spacious, permit-only spots for luxury sedans. I walk along the dried-up fountain in front of our building, and I could be strolling in a warehouse district. Only Ketchup Co., among the street's few remaining tenants, retains the original integrity. And in the business district's entire history, only Ketchup Co., with its plush walls and marble parquet floors, has improved on the original ideal. I walk in the direction of my apartment. Without looking back, I see the Ketchup building in my mind's eye, or in Mr. Ketchup's eye, and it says to me, "We keep on going. We keep improving. We keep on keeping on." It is true. Despite all of Roger Weathering's efforts to drag the company down, all of Stanley's horsing around and Judd's apathy, sales have gone up. Despite efforts on the business side to confuse distribution and hamper advertising, the workers on the factory side keep producing pluperfect products. Obviously, Roger Weathering's lethargy will win out because he has entropy on his side. It is only a matter of time and gravity. But I can take the vision of extra perfection elsewhere. As the house falls, I will build again elsewhere. My apartment is 15 blocks, a mile and a half away. I make the walk in all weather. Today, the cloud cover is low and immobile, a drab blue with thinner patches of brightness. If my hands were not in my pockets, they would be cold. As I move away from the business district, the large buildings give way to commercialized railroad-age houses that hold small businesses. Pager salesmen, accountants, barbers, daycare centers fill in the economy of the imperfect, offering cut-rate replicas of commerce models that made their originators wealthy. 50, 100, 500 years distant from the seminal entrepreneurial idea, these knockoffs exist in the margins of profit. I want nothing to do with them, but a man must have his hair cut. Now, passing last week's barbershop, I look at my reflection in the window. I'm ashamed of it, and know it is beautiful. The barber is dozing in his straight-back chair, and one of those preachers is screaming, even through the shop front windows. "What do you want? Do you want to know where I live? Any verse you want, come and see, I know 'em all. If you can't believe the plain-out truth, you thick-headed people, come and see. Any verse you want, and I will tell it to you. No teleprompters, no speakers in my ears. Oh, my people." It's disgusting. But from a marketing angle, it's very good. Come and see. Try it. Free of charge. Money-back guarantee. But the people are duped, I know, because come and see is not free of charge. It takes your time, which is money, and takes your commitment. Oh, my people. Redeem your damn time. Don't listen to this charlatan. I am almost home. The block is shabby, littered with the post-urban equivalent of abandoned boxcars, shopping carts given up like pig dice, lying on preposterous resting points, their wheels in the air, or balanced only on the child's seat baskets or on their fenders. They almost fall off porch stoops. They teeter off curbs. Some, filled with syrupy plastic bags of crushed cans, disintegrate into gutters. They mind their own business, just as trashed as my co-workers. But simple, too, like them. They could be sculptures of a new kingdom, in remembrance of an old kingdom. Oh, my people, how ugly you are. Here is my block, its half-deserted streets. My house is wrapped in smog, the wheezings of a diseased cat. It's the middle of the day, but the air is so dark that the streetlights turn on, which is one of those things you rarely see, and the romantic soul is supposed to relish. The lights just make my house's bricks, once red, yellower. The stoop, which immigrant Germans once sat on in the cool of the evening to gossip, is covered with trash. At the door, I reach into my pocket for my key and pull out the usual gob of pocket accumulation. Receipts, lint, gum wrappers, to-do post-it notes, but apparently no keys. I search the conglomeration more carefully and find the sacred heart I had pulled from the conference room door. In small, handwritten letters, it says, "Ketchup is the Antichrist." I roll my eyes and still discover no keys. Either they are on the other side of the door, or, yes, in the briefcase I left in the conference room, of course, for Christ's sake. I ring the bells of my neighbors, but no one is home. I could go back to the office, but the thought of my job and the possibility of simply walking out on Ketchup Co. stalls me. I still must consider what I'm going to do about that. But now I am hungry. The gourmet Coke's acidity has gnawed through my breakfast Cheerios and is eating at my stomach lining. I can't think before I have something to eat, but I can't eat before I do something about getting into my house. Two blocks away is a payphone where I can call my landlord. He can let me in, he says. Oh, where I call my landlord. He can let me in, he says, in an hour, but I can't wait that long to eat. I am famished now and have $4 in my wallet, so I cross the street to Jim's Spaghetti Diner. Jim's is an institution in this part of the city, a memorial to mediocrity. I eat here only when desperate, but some of my neighbors lunch here every day. The cooks, all ex-cons, boil the spaghetti until it will stick to the tiled kitchen walls and serve it in a greasy puddle of ground beef and tomato aspic. Oh, that's where I heard the word. I didn't know what tomato aspic was. That doesn't work here. We had tomato aspic for Thanksgiving for the first time. It's like gelatinized tomato in a jello mold. The space was not originally intended for a diner, so a broad, empty pad of linoleum separates the booths lining the walls. A waitress approaches out of the dissipated acrid smoke drifting at eye level, walking distractedly along a grimy track on the linoleum. I choose the booth farthest from the smoking section, but even this side is stale with smoke. The waitress flips her order pad open and leans one hip against the table, saying nothing. Her hair is frizzed and matted at the same time, dirty blonde roots growing out under a faded red tint. She can't be more than 25, and her figure is not naturally obese, but her hips and buttocks already bulge tightly under her greasy cotton pants. Her red and pink blotched face, thick with the sediment of spatters from the grill, breaks my heart, because she should not be old enough to have given up on makeup. "Well," she says. I glance at the menu to see what I can afford. "Grilled cheese," I say, "with tomato. That all?" "A water, too. And do you have ketchup?" "Sure." She hasn't written anything down when she waddles away. Why don't they have ketchup out on the table? Why doesn't the waitress take care of herself? "Oh, my people, you don't have to be ugly. You don't have to hock the phlegm deep in your esophagus between every bite, like the man in the union jacket at the smoking table opposite me. Oh, mother, two booths away. You don't have to feed your dirty 3-year-old chocolate pudding from a can or stand him up on the padded booth bench or dress him in Power Rangers pajamas when you take him out for lunch. You don't have to wear your sweatpants and a long pink glittered t-shirt that covers your butt when you take your son out for lunch. And yet, why don't I dare talk to them? Why don't I bring them the gospel of extra perfection?" And of course, now the tears come, because I know the answer, because I have nothing to offer them. I have nothing to offer the union man, who has made it tolerably well to his 60s, and will retire and receive his pension in 2 years, and dedicate the rest of his life to his garden. Oh, mother, with your giggling child, and motherly smile, your face lined like the monthly water bill, let you wallow in your sub-perfect contentment, your happy-ishness. How could I presume? And what if they truly are beautiful and the mistake is mine? But oh, linoleum floor! If only you were removed of your grease and made of marble parquet instead of linoleum, I would skate across you, would describe slow figures of eight upon you, while declaiming my gospel of extra perfection to the patrons in their booths. Get behind me, tears! Mediocrity, be damned! Complacency, you are for the damned! Perfection, step aside! The world is glutted with perfection! We shall go beyond perfection! And yet, my stomach grumbles, a little grilled cheese at this day and hour would not be too bad. But beware the temptation, my stomach, of grilled cheese and such like products of the grill. Greases dull the passions. Were it not for these greasy people, this grimy place, those sleazy co-workers at Ketchup Co. who made me leave my keys, I would not face this danger. If only I weren't so hungry, if only it weren't rude to the waitress and short-order cooks, I would leave before my order comes. It seems now that I am bound by the reciprocity of my syllogism. If all these other formerly despised people, then I, with that weepy song binding us together, that inane ditty, the fulcrum upon which my syllogism has just turned on me. The waitress returns, my triangle-cut grilled cheese sandwich skating around on the over-large plate as she slides it across the table. There's no ketchup. I say, could I get some ketchup with that? Hold your horses, she says. She reaches into her apron and produces a small squirt bottle of Heinz ketchup. I meant ketchup, you know, gourmet ketchup. She laughs through her nose. What do you think this place is? She slaps the check on the table and walks away. I turn, raising my finger to catch her attention, but she is gone, and I do not have my water. The ketchup bottle glares at me. I snatch it, screw off the cap, and sniff. It smells not unlike ketchup. I inspect the ingredients. Natural flavorings, corn syrup, vinegar, processed tomato concentrate. What were they thinking? Who would want to buy something with these ingredients? And yet, I am craving the sweet acidity of tomato and vinegar. It has been so long since I have had regular ketchup. Maybe it is not so terrible. Besides, it can't be possible to ruin this light, rigid slab of white bread and American cheese. I squirt an experimental dab onto a corner of the sandwich and take a bite, leaving a cast of my teeth in the sandwich's edge. Blech. As I expected, it is much too sweet, too liquid, too smooth of texture. It lacks a certain pastiness that the simian collagen evokes from the tomato and the ketchup brand. To be fair, though, its lack of viscosity complements the sliminess of the half-melted American cheese. I try another dab. It is not bad. No, that's not true. It is bad. But it is not as bad as one might expect. After all, we must remember, Heinz ketchup is perfect, and perfect things are never entirely bad. I suppose it is the way of the world, this world, that most things are never quite as disappointing as we expect, except insofar as we are disappointed by their tolerability. And, alas, my third bite is really quite good. With more than a dab, possibly three dabs, of ketchup, the sandwich is delicious. The red of the ketchup complements the bread's toasted yellow and the goldfinch gold of the American cheese. The mustardy yellow of ketchup could not compare. By the time I get to the last bite, I am sniffling for the beauty and goodness of it, because it is beautiful. Under a different sign, according to a lower or higher standard, the ketchup, and especially the combination of white bread, American cheese, and ketchup, is more beautiful than ketchup. And my haircut, in the shining of the laminated menu, I see that it is an excellent haircut. My God, I'm sniffling. I am a handsome man. The kid two booths away is staring at me, frozen in mid-bounce on the springy seat, with the quizzical expression of a dog whose master has just stubbed his toe and is whimpering and cursing in pain. His mother glances over her shoulder, then yanks her kid around, but she, too, looks compassionate. I never asked for these compassions. I never asked to fall to this level of taste. I must get out. I put the $3.75 for the sandwich on the table, then rifle my pockets for a tip. I find no change, but I decide the Sacred Heart will do. A quarter and a Sacred Heart. Ketchup is the Antichrist. I get out before the waitress can return. Out on the sidewalk, the whole world is gray now. All this ugly shit presents itself to me as beautiful, and there's nothing I can do, nothing more than snuffling and pawing at my nose and my eyes. And is there nothing more I can do? My control is slipping. This syllogism no longer originates with me. E is this world, these pissy clouds, the greasy mother and child, buffoonish Stanley and idiotic Judd, this dissipated neighborhood. And I am the contingency, a tail flipped flippantly at the end of the syllogism. If E, then I. Furthermore, the whole alphabet continues beyond E, all the way to Z, and Z is a presence whose effect on me, though separated by 24 degrees, is disturbingly intimate. But even my lack of control, my being an end, a conclusion, pleases the perverse, sniveling side of me. Oh, my people, what are you doing to me? Have mercy upon us. From the end of the block, I see my landlord waiting for me at my apartment. His bald head gleams in the yellow light as he squints soporifically through his half-blind eyes. I try my best to dry my face with my shirt tail. Oh, hello, he says as I walk up the steps. I realize that I have woken him up, remembering that he sleeps during the day and takes care of his ailing mother by night. Thanks for coming, I say. I hope you haven't been waiting long. Oh, only 10 minutes, he says apologetically. I stand by the door waiting as his glaucous eyes gaze over my shoulder. Oh, there you are. Dear me, I suppose you want to get in. Yes, if it's not too much trouble. I find myself adopting his obsequious tone. He unlocks the door with quivering hands, then laboriously unwinds the key from his keyring. I'll just leave this under the mat until you find your key, if that's all right. Are you sure? Oh, yes, yes. I mean, if that's okay with you. Yes, it's fine. Thank you. Oh, damn me. I almost forgot. A fellow left this for you. I'm sorry I didn't catch his name. He had a little bit of a German accent, I'd say. He holds out a piece of paper toward the porch steps. Right here, I say, from inside the door, and he swivels around. Oh, there you are. Lord have mercy, these eyes. I take the paper. Well, I don't want to bother you any more than I already have. Not at all. I bothered you. Thank you, he says. Thank you, I say to his back, and he walks toward his car. In the light of the hallway, I open the folded piece of paper to find it is Ketchup Co. stationery. The note says, in a gorgeous 19th century hand, hope you don't mind. Didn't want to surprise. Your landlord let me in. Mirka. Hello. A shock of fright, even though I've just been warned, spins me around to face a slender man, younger and taller than I, standing with the posture of a very confident person trying to act uncertain. His hands are conspicuously fidgeting on the handle of a tightly furled umbrella that rests comfortably on its tip between his feet. Did I scare you? I hope not. He smiles as if welcoming me to his own house. No, well, yes, a little at first, but I'm fine now. I got your note. We've never met before. Not formally, but I have seen you around. He speaks precisely, and yes, with a slight German accent, which I can't do anymore. I'm sorry for the intrusion, but I need to talk to you urgently. Oh, well, let's sit down. Can I take your... I look him over for a coat and find my briefcase on the floor next to his feet. Is that my... Yes, I took the liberty. Well, I have never been around people who take liberties. At Ketchup Co., we conduct business professionally, according to a tacit code that we all understand. Well, thank you, I say. My landlord is still with me. I hope it wasn't too much trouble. He looks at me incredulously, with a conspiratorial smile. Come on, how can it be a trouble? It is only a briefcase. I lead him into my living room, which I am glad to have cleaned over my long weekend. Immediately upon entering, I feel better, surrounded by the sparse, pluperfect decor. My apartment is as tastefully decorated as can be expected from a person on my salary. Thanks to Mr. Ketchup's help, I have 2 late Warhol prints over my white leather sofa, and a slightly damaged Liechtenstein action sequence over my antique Eames chair. I offer Mirka a seat on the sofa, where he can easily browse my selection of avant-garde magazines on the bluntly squared teak coffee table. But he doesn't even glance at the table. He leans forward with keen blue eyes fixed on mine. "I hear," he says, "that you have been having some trouble at the office." How can he presume? "Well," I mumble. He swipes a hand through the air. "It doesn't matter. I have a business proposition. Maybe a new career for you." Visions of the gourmet Taco Bell flicker in the air, but they flicker because the tears are rising again. "I am starting a recording company," he continues. "A bit out of the ordinary. Recording silences, actually. Everyone is different."
"Who?"
"The silences. Every silence is different, depending on the context and who is being silent. I thought you might, seeing as you've lost your job."
"I have?
I'm sorry, I thought you knew. I thought that is why you left the office early." He waits for the news to settle, but it doesn't. I am overwhelmed by the reversal of my syllogism. Since when do things happen to me? "I also hear that you have..." It's hard to put it just right. I hope you are not offended. "That is, they say you have been weeping."
"Yes?"
I try to deny it, but I choke on the tears that fill my throat, rising to fill my whole being. "Yes!" Mirka shouts. He jumps to his feet. "That's it! The silence of the weeping soul. The eloquent silence. The silence of the contrite heart."
"Beautiful."
I try to protest, but still can't speak. So I rise, too, hoping to convey with furious tremors my rejection of his aesthetic. I have been betrayed by ketchup into the hands of mediocrity. Oh, weakness! Oh, deceitful perfection! Mirka has a microphone in his hands. He's fiddling with a digital contraption.
This is so appropriate.
"I hope you don't mind," he whispers urgently. "I've taken the liberty. A screen test, as it were." As he holds the microphone towards me, the tears overflow my eyes. I fight them with tight squints, but it is no use. My face is soaked. Finally, I sit back down, defeated and exhausted. Mirka clicks a switch and withdraws the microphone. "It is a wrap," he says. "It is perfect." "No," I say weakly, "this is outrageous." "Here." He produces a paper from his breast pocket. "A contract. You see, it is very generous. I already have a handsome investment." I look. It is very generous. It is enough to live comfortably for 4 months, or for two, while tucking the rest away as seed money for my venture. "This is absurd," I say. Mirka giggles. "Maybe, yes." "Perfect," he says, "and perhaps it is. But I cannot debase myself. I will not give in to this posture, this profit of sentiment. I will yet rise above the perfect. And yet, I need the money. That is a fact, and I would not have to debase myself. Not for long, at least. What would Mr. Ketchup do?" His memory is fading. He seems now like a mermaid, conceivable only within that small mythic setting I have imagined for him. He was real, but now he seems less than real. His song no longer travels to me across the myriad levels of syllogistic contingency. Oh, Mr. Ketchup, I have no choice. I seize the pen Mirka has produced and briskly sign my name to the contract. Mirka extends his hand, which I shake absently. "Welcome to Frisured Productions," he says, but I hardly hear him. When I put the pen down, I am convinced I have made the best choice of all possible choices. A great peace begins hideously to settle over me. I struggle to retain perspective, and when I throw back my head to scream out my protest, only this wail, constrained to the simple Gregorian scale, emerges. "Have mercy upon us." The end. How much time do you have? How long did it take?
54 minutes.
54 minutes and it's still recording?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Oh, that was much longer than I thought.
Did you change the quality?
What?
Did you change the quality to get more time?
No, I think it just is working.
All right, thanks for the story.
Thanks for letting me read it.
Lamb of God who shaved us away the sins.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever hear that the same. So, why'd you pick ketchup?
You mean instead of other things? I actually wrote this story before I heard the Garrison Keillor ketchup thing.
I don't know the Garrison Keillor
ketchup advisory board.
Yeah. I picked ketchup just because, I don't know. I was actually talking to this to a friend about this one time, and we were sort of plotting to make a gourmet Taco Bell. And this was when, at least, we were first being introduced to sort of the foodie culture and everything. And it was like, it was like, how can you, what can you take that's like the most common, just like white bread kind of thing, and make it gourmet, you know?
Ketchup.
So, from basically the time that he leaves Ketchup Co., I have like four different endings for this story.
Yeah.
And I'm now really though attached to everything that happens. Well, no, basically from the time that he leaves the restaurant, the Jim Spaghetti House, I have four different endings. But yeah, so I'm definitely attached to that. But after that, I have a whole thing where he gets married to the barber's niece. And there's like three paragraphs that summarize like the next 5 years of his life. But Mirka comes in there too, and he records their silences, and then they go agrarian, and they're like sitting on the porch while she's pregnant, and Mirka like does a second, like his weeping silences have been so successful and they've sold so well that he comes and records their like the silences of love after they're married, rocking on the porch. And so, but I don't know. I'm finding it difficult to, I guess I like this ending more now than I have before, but I'm finding it difficult to find a good way to end the story. Or should it end way earlier?
No, it's a good end point there because it provides for future continuity.
For future continuity? Yeah. That's what a lot of people have said, actually. They've been like, well, this doesn't seem like a short story. It seems like it should continue into a novel or something like that.
End of chapter.
End of chapter? Yeah. Yeah. But I feel like I've said everything I want to say about, you know, the things I'm saying things about.
Yeah, I feel like you really got some of the sort of like office dynamics.
That actually happened, right?
Yeah. The, like the sort of like people are sort of like the defensiveness against like getting more work and of like people not like appreciating like all the work you already have to do and feeling like there's these like very like these like conversations where they go a certain way, then you can like manipulate and sort of pressure, sort of get the whole sort of brute pressure to like pressure people to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, just setting the sort of this fellow's ambitions in like such completely like bleak sort of I guess sort of putting his ambitions in like such a sort of bleak path is, it's really, like, I guess I find that pretty, like, stirring. Like, you know, that he has, like, these professions for these ambitions for the extra perfect, but that it's in, like, you know, kind of, like, just kind of, yeah, ketchup and, like,
mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like just marketing stuff, like getting people to pay too much money for stupid things.
That's only part of it. It keeps on building upon all these nuances and discombobulated things that we're faced with. because, hey, the assholes do control most of what's going on in the TV show, the office and everything. Everybody else knows what's going on except the boss. And it's a truism, and there are a lot of truisms throughout. So it feels, it reminds me of Catherine the Ride of sorts. Here's a person going through various scenarios and ending up in Central Park and here, there, and the other place.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I think there's probably a ton of Salinger in sort of the way that I navigated through the story.
A little bit of Shakespeare in there and a little bit of history and a lot of business and management, and it's a perfect story.
Thank you.
Doesn't have to end there.
What got you, what gave you the idea of sort of making the character sort of like so emotionally unstable?
Because we all are.
I don't know, I really...
I like it, but...
That's throughout all of American literature. It's always that character that's telling the story. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about Harry Penn or anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's...
It's never the big hero of White Knight and everything. It's the person who's wondering what's going on and has his perspective, but he doesn't know what the other person's perspective is.
Yeah, I mean, the emotional volatility comes from... when I was writing this, I was really, at this time, trying to negotiate the role of emotion in my religious life, which... being raised as an evangelical was huge. And so, you know, that was something I was trying to figure out and work through. Like, emotion is a real sign of spirituality, you know? At least that was, you know, that was the conception. And I still think it is. And I think that that's, like, the emotion he's feeling is sort of genuine. Like, that's where some of the truth is coming from, his emotion. But then his emotion is also betraying him in certain ways. And
make your point a lot better than Madonna does going up and for us to tell the same story.
Yeah, yeah. Madonna, that's I don't know if Madonna has a place in this story.
Wait, which Madonna are we talking about?
The pop song.
No, was the special on the other night that nobody saw.
That was in Russia, right?
No, where the incident blew up was probably. But this was in
what?
The studio. When
something
blew
up,
she was going on a tour.
The cross blew up?
No, the Corson, the reportage.
Oh, yeah. The Russia thing. It was about Russia, right?
I'm not even sure. It was in Europe. On the way to Italy. Whichever the last stop was, but now she is here, did it in this country.
Uh-huh. Nobody cares in this country.
She had a special
sort of
TV,
crucified.
And the big question was, would she hang herself up on the cross as she sang one song? And the last minute she chickened out because she had done it elsewhere and it raised a lot of controversy. But then nobody watched the show the other night.
Did you?
No. I didn't know. But the religious, the image is beautiful.